Welcome, everyone. Today, we're going to be interviewing the author of My Father's List,
Laura Carney. And yes, the book is called My Father's List, How Living My Dad's Dreams Set Me Free. And it is such a beautiful interview. She lives in Montclair, and she discusses so many different topics, how she found many years after her father passed away, his bucket list. And then she went about doing every single item on that list.
Right, right. In the first part of this interview, we learn about the tragic accident of her father and what led her to activism about talking on the phone while you're driving. And we learn a little bit, and we're going to put some information about this on our website about some statistics and what is the more dangerous and the things that have changed. And she talks to us about that. But what I really loved about talking about the list and everything is understanding that just the emotional journey of how this list has transformed her and how it applied to her life, and how now she's got a new philosophy on life based on this list. And she was telling us about how, and I just want to throw this in, is that people should stay through the whole interview to hear about how she has changed to understand how to write lists
and how to coach people how to write their own bucket lists.
Yeah.
So that they can start living more meaningfully and purposefully every day.
It's a great interview. I hope everybody enjoys it and also goes out and buys her book, My Father's List. Welcome. Welcome to the show, Laura. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to meet you too.
Can you tell people a little bit more about how all of this came about in your story?
Sure. Well, I've lived in New Jersey actually now for, I want to say, let's see, here in Montclair, I've lived here for 14 years. And then before that, we lived over in Netcong, that area, for I think about 2 or 3 years. I was basically a transplant from Delaware. And as soon as I had left Delaware in 2003, my father died because of a distracted driver. Mm-hmm. And I was just like recently out of college. I was an intern at a magazine in New York. And that's when I got the phone call 3 months after I moved there. It was a teenager who was making a phone call at a red light. And, you know, when you do that, it's kind of a concept not a lot of people know about. But I mean, I didn't know about it for another decade until they started kind of recruiting me to do this activism. It's kind of like a blindness that happens to you when they call it attention blindness. When you're driving and you pick up the phone, you know, it's like you're sort of get tunnel vision. So it makes it more difficult to see things on like the outer skirts of the windshield. So when I learned that, I was like, oh my God, she really didn't see the green or the red light. Because in the trial, she said it was green. And she seemed like a really nice girl. Like, I didn't think she was just making that up.
Yeah.
And that's why it always made it really hard for me to vilify her, because she was just a 16-year-old girl, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So I really think it was that attentional blindness that happened, that a lot of people don't realize that when they are using the phone, you know, you could even be like in your driveway, like on your street, like a street you're on all the time, but you really don't know what might be coming out of right or left field. So it makes it more difficult to respond to something like that.
Yeah. And I think it's only gotten progressively worse with all the different options you have on your phone and the many different distractions that just keep getting piled on.
Well, yeah. And the reason that happened is because at one point people sort of started developing this theory that nobody uses the phone anymore, that everybody texts now, like they don't actually make phone calls. Mm-hmm. So basically car companies and, you know, Apple and AT&T and the ones that are designing, like, you know, the Bluetooth technology and the things you can use in the car, they started saying like what they were doing was now safer by giving you the dashboard tech and by giving you like a hands-free option. Because now at least like, you're not going to pick up your phone and text on it.
Right, right.
That's right. Like that became the main focus. But the issue for people like me was that in my case, my dad didn't die because of someone who was texting. He died because of someone who was talking. And there's still that attention blindness that happens to your brain if you're taking that time to talk. And I mean, this girl was on a highway, you know, so she had just gotten off an off ramp. So that's really not a good place to be doing that anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, I spent the first couple of years as a really young person, because I was only 25 when it happened. I spent the first couple of years very angry about it.
Yeah.
And I sort of had this theory that if only I could make sure I got that darn journalism job that I moved there for, then everything would be okay. I could still pretend I was living a normal life. And suddenly this like grief and anger was just going to resolve itself. And of course that did not happen at all. I'm still carrying it with me. And then, you know, I still managed to do pretty well. Like I found a job at Good Housekeeping 10 years later, and I was there for about 7 years as a copy editor. And then my husband proposed. And there really was just, there was something about the timing of both becoming an activist, that also happened because of Good Housekeeping, by the way. Someone wrote a story about distracted driving.
Oh.
And I read it and I thought, oh my God, this is what happened. Like that was what happened to my dad. I should probably do something. So I became a public speaker, and then my husband proposed, and it was like, there was just something about it that triggered all of these feelings again that I had when my dad died. Because it's like, now I have to remember, oh, he's not going to be there at the wedding.
Yeah.
You know, right, it was like, it was 10, 13 years later. It was 13 years later when I did walk down the aisle, but he wasn't in body. I mean, I think in spirit he was there, but in body he wasn't standing next to me. And I needed to do something about that anger. And then 6 months after the wedding, we were visiting my brother in his brand new house. He's like, hey, do you know about this? Because I found this list that dad wrote when he was 29. And well, we actually didn't know that yet. My mom told us that later, but he was 29 when he wrote it, just after I was born. And it was a list of like 60 things. And at the top of it, it said things I would like to do in my lifetime. And I just had this light bulb moment where it was like, oh my God, this is it. This is the solution. This list of these incredible adventures my dad wanted to go on. And it wasn't all adventures. It was also really sweet goals for the family and for himself. Like that's the narrative I'm supposed to be telling, because it shows, you know, it's not like me giving a speech that's just, here's how my dad died on that awful day.
Right.
It's, here's 54 years of a beautiful life. And here's all the things he wanted to do, because I think everyone can relate to that we all have dreams, that we all have.
Exactly.
So that's really how it started. And that's why I made the crazy decision to do all of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a amazing transition to how this happened. I didn't realize all of that. I just thought that you had found the list and, you know, decided to do I didn't realize there was such a important activism behind it to try to get people aware of the fact that we need to be less distracted when we drive. And this is, have you found that message is being found in this?
Yeah. I mean, there were 60, and luckily he had checked off 5 of them. So I only had 54, but I always thought that was really like sweet that it was 54, because he was 54 when he died.
And
that number actually came up a lot. Like I went to Super Bowl 54, it just kept happening. So, and then I found out that in Roman numerals, the number 54 is spelled out LIV. Which just gave me chills.
Okay.
Wow.
What if this is just celebrating living? You know, what if that's what he wants me to do? And that is a thing that happened a lot while I was doing the list, was I felt like he was speaking to me. Mm-hmm. I felt like he was guiding me. And there would be these miraculous turns of events that, you know, my husband is a witness to it. Like, you know, because he's a much more skeptical person than I am. But he's like, you can't explain this. How did this show up at this time? And this person was here. And that was, you know, things, even to the point of like, one of the items was own a black tux. And I had a friend from college who, like, you know, kind of a loose friend, we were acquaintances. He showed up on my Instagram one day. He's like, I'd love to help you with a list item. My father died last year and I wish he had a list. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, let me figure out which one it should be. And it turns out he's a photographer now. So I said, I think it should be own a black tux. You should photograph me wearing this thing. And then I'll really feel like I'm quote unquote owning it, even though I did actually buy it. I searched for weeks for this tuxedo, thinking I'm going to be swimming in this thing. I'm going to look so ridiculous. You know, it's going to look like, you know, a woman wearing her father's clothes or something. And finally, one day I walked out of my apartment and there's a boutique down there called Coco.
Yeah.
In the front window. And there was a black woman's tuxedo on a
Wow.
In the window. I opened the door.
What are the chances of that?
And I'm getting chills even talking about it. The woman who owns the store is named Roz. And I was like, Roz, she was like helping a customer. I'm like, Roz, is that a tuxedo? And she's like, yeah. And it turned out they only had one size left and it was my size.
Okay. That's just too much.
That is too much.
Stuff like that happened all the time. Like to me, it was like, because my dad was such an easygoing, funny person. It was always to me this message of stop trying so hard. You know, you should be having fun, like enjoy being alive.
And I wanted to that point, I did want to ask you about your dad, because we're talking about a list and what you did. But I am always fascinated by, you know, where people come from and their journey as children and the transition to adults. Like, what was your dad like as a father and as a person?
He was just an amazing, unique human being. He wasn't perfect, of course. I made a real effort in the book to describe the relationship as it was, which was real. My parents divorced when I was six. He was a salesman and a writer and an artist. He also was like a real free spirit. So I think of it as being a freelancer. I think of it as normal now that I'm always going job to job.
Yeah.
But at the time when I found the list, I was dead set. I have to be a full-time employee, you know, like, and a lot of that came from the fact that I wanted to work in a creative profession, but I wanted it to be very secure.
Stable. Yeah.
Yeah. Like Good Housekeeping to me was the most stable magazine there was. Mm-hmm. Being a copy editor, you know, they always say the copy editors go last if there's layoffs because there's a production, you know? So that was sort of why I chose that and went in that direction. Cause I had watched my dad just be this big ideas man and go from one job to the next and one car to the next and one girlfriend to the next. And his life was sort of just always in motion. And as a teenager, I would get resentful of that because I would just think, why can't you be a normal dad like all the other dads? Why are you the one telling me about the jokes you told last night when you went out, you know, dancing and you're still singing, I don't know. He would sing the corniest, like, 1990s songs that we play at the nightclub the night before. And he just was an entertainer. He was an entertainer by nature, but he also was very introspective and very intelligent and well-read. And he was a writer. And I think writing was one of his biggest passions. It's interesting because as I was doing the list, it wasn't just the list that I found. I continued to find more artifacts of like just things that he had, like notebooks he had, outlines he'd made for his own book, a list of how he planned to self-publish something. He had a book he wrote in the 70s. So I did have that one and he talked about it all the time growing up. And then halfway through the list, my husband surprised me and he designed it as like a real book and you can now buy it on Amazon.
Oh, wow.
That's great.
And it's like incredible. But I mean, my dad would have thought that was amazing because he died in 2003 before anybody could do something like that.
But
he just... when he died, I thought of him as someone who was so creative and so talented, but didn't get to see all of his dreams through. I feel like I didn't answer your question properly earlier.
No.
That Jeanette who asked me that about the distracted driving.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. So I would say probably the greatest evidence of that being successful that I have found is I did an event in Philadelphia where I spoke in a bookstore and the woman who was interviewing me was an old college friend who's now a painter. And she told me the way she read the book was by listening to the audiobook. Mm-hmm. And she listened to it in her car and her 9-year-old daughter would listen to it with her. And her 9-year-old would be annoyed if she had like skipped ahead and she missed the chapter. And I was like, oh, wow, that's so cute. That's so cute. I'm so glad you did that. And one day she said, Maya told me the other day, Mom, you can't use your phone while driving. You need to stop doing that. Cause she had heard that part of the book. Like she had heard what had happened and it never even occurred to me like, oh, if I get to narrate the audio book too, that's how people are going to read this. And that might make it click, you know?
Well, that's curious. I mean, what's making me think is what's the difference between listening to an audio book in your car and talking on the phone?
Oh, I'm happy that came up because so basically there's a whole chart that the National Safety Council created and that's what they gave us. And they showed us like it's basically there's different levels of distraction. Mm-hmm. And the way they determined that was they did this study where they did, you know, they put electrodes on people's heads or they can show where their eyes are going.
Yep.
And they would test it with the different activities, you know, putting on makeup, eating food, listening to the radio, listening to an audiobook, listening to a podcast, touching your GPS, whatever it might be. And they were able to determine the actual level of distraction that would happen and how much was acceptable, like how much was too much. So basically what they found is that anything that's taking your eyes, obviously, off of the windshield, whether that's texting or fiddling with something, or, you know, I have friends who've lost a loved one because someone was reaching for a drink. You know, it could be any, like just doing it for too long, anything like that. That's going to be too much. Talking on the phone was a thing where it did something where basically you're only now seeing 25% of the windshield. So this center part is what you're seeing, but you're not, like, your brain doesn't register that you're not seeing the outer part. Mm-hmm. So that, of course, the percentage of that is too much of a load. But then when they got down to audiobooks and podcasts and just listening to the GPS, not necessarily messing around with it, but listening to it, those were fine. Like they weren't bad enough that you needed to not do it.
If you have that chart, would you email it to us? Because sure. it'd be good for us to post on social media and put it in our show notes after.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I mean, one of the reasons I think that it's not super public is because, you know, quite honestly, car makers want to keep tech in cars. Mm-hmm. They want millennials like tech.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. And, you know, having the safety precautions that they've added now to cars is a huge help.
Yeah.
But to me, it's almost like assuming, oh, this is just going to keep getting worse and people are going to keep being on their phones.
It is. It's saying the cat's out of the bag and we can't take it, put it back in. So let's add all this extra tech to beep and alert you and shake your wheel and do all these other things so that you can be aware that you're about to do something terrible.
Yeah. And I mean, eventually we'll all be in self-driving cars, so it will be okay.
But yeah, I mean, it's true. It is very true. It will happen.
I wanted to ask of your list, one question was there something that seemed really difficult for you to do, but when you ended up doing it, it wasn't? Like that you were like, I can't do that. I'm going to wait to do that number till much later. But then when you actually got to do it, you felt, oh my gosh, this is okay. And then something that seemed super easy, I'm just going to go and do it. But emotionally, it was super hard.
Yeah, I have two immediately that came to mind.
Great.
The first one was correspond with the Pope. Uh-huh. Everybody thought that would be the hardest one. I thought it would be the hardest one. And that's why I put it off for 6 years.
I read that one and I was like, that was probably hard, you know? He was just like, hey. Just texted you right back.
Like, what's up? No, people did joke, oh, you should go on Twitter. And I actually tried that a couple times, but first of all, we can't refer to him as he. He doesn't use the pronoun he. He says his holiness.
Right. It's his holiness. Yes.
That's very perfect.
How did I know that?
Not tweet back or retweet. So is it even called tweet anymore? Is it react?
I don't know.
I've heard people still call it tweet on the news. So I don't know.
That's true. I just, you know, I researched it, found out that I had a friend who knew of a priest in New York. He's a Jesuit priest. And he actually, you know, he's sort of like a celebrity Jesuit priest. His name's James Martin. That's right. James Martin. He actually has worked with Martin Scorsese on like a documentary on LGBTQ in the church. So I got to talk to him. He did respond to me and he told me what I needed to do, that I just, you know, there's a certain, if you're Catholic, and I was baptized Catholic and I had my first communion after the divorce, my mom converted us to Episcopalianism, but I'm still technically Catholic. So you give like a special greeting if you're Catholic. So of course I did that. And there's websites that tell you, here's how you need to start the letter. Here's how you end it, and keep it short and keep it very specific about what it is that has happened in your family or in your life and what you would like him to pray for. And that's what I did. And what I ended up talking to him about was phone addiction, because that's one of his platforms. He likes to talk to kids about going outside and not being on their phones too much. And at that point you know, I wasn't really doing the activism so much anymore, because as I did the list, something started to shift in me where I was no longer angry. Mm, you know, yeah. I had this acceptance that my father had died this way, because otherwise, if he hadn't, how could I be having this incredible journey and adventure that was making me grow and was making me better? But at the same time, I still felt like this is a thing that needs to change. And maybe what I'm doing can help. And some days when the list was too hard, that's where my brain would go, to those families of the people I met who had a child die. Like, I have to do this for them. So to have that topic in common and to say, hey, I really think it's not even anymore about convenience or ignorance when people do that. I think it's more about addiction. I think now people are just so used to being on their phones, even if they use the bathroom, it's become almost like attached to our bodies that when you do get in the car, it's like you could very absentmindedly just use it and not even remember you're in a car. Mm-hmm. So that's what I talked to him about. And I got a response 6 weeks later. And it was from, so what he does is, what His Holiness does is he has the all of these assistants and they'll respond and he says they hold his heart. I think he has four of them. And if it's an extremely urgent matter, you'll actually get a letter back from him. I think somebody in this area got one from him and it was published in the New York Times a couple years ago. But yeah, so it was his assistant. And I actually later found out that the guy who wrote me back had just started the job that day. So I think I just had very lucky timing with that. Like, oh, okay. You know, I imagine if it's your first day, you'll be a little less discerning.
Yeah. But that's also another one of those happenstances. What was the one that you thought was easy, but turned out to be hard?
Well, this was a kind of a theme that repeated itself throughout the list, which was that anytime I thought something was easy, I was proven vastly incorrect. like anytime I was arrogant, like, oh, this is a piece of cake, you know? Anytime I had like a nice flow of list items happening and I'd be like, oh, okay, here's the one I got to do today. And not even like appreciating it, you know, like, cause my friend said to me once, I think it was my friend who did the tuxedo photo shoot. He's like, how do you celebrate after a list item? Do you go home and have champagne? Yeah. And I said, no, the list item is the celebration. Like just the fact that I have this thing that my dad wanted to do, like doing it is how I'm celebrating him and that relationship. I really needed to give each item that amount of reverence, even, you know, type 40 words a minute correctly, like even that one.
Yeah.
So it ended up being a nice moment with my brother. You know, he of course did 63 words and did it right the first time. You know, I'm the one who's a writer and he's an accountant. He still beat me and enjoyed it. But as far as to answer your question, what did I think would be the easiest and actually was really hard? The tennis item. Mm-hmm. There was an item on there that said beat a number one seed in tennis.
Oh, that's hard. You thought that was going to be easy?
Well, I played tennis.
Oh, okay.
Team in high school. Like that was like the one sport. That was the one sport I was confident in, you know? Oh, and I actually, but here's the other reason I thought the notebook paper was folded over the word tournament. So I thought it just said beat a number one seed in tennis.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't see the word tournament. I thought I just have to score 1 point. Yeah.
Beat like win a point.
Mm-hmm.
1 point. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That counts as beating them in something. Yeah. So I went out there and I played against my husband's best friend, who's a tennis coach, absolutely a number one seed. I thought all I have to do is score 1 point on him. I'll check this off, you know, one off the to-do list, move on to the next. Because a lot of this really was me juggling how to do all of these things at once. And I would try to like double up or triple up, especially if they were travel things.
Yeah.
So we did this in York, Pennsylvania. And the first day out on the tennis court, Craig said he would go easy on me. He did not go easy on me. And I basically leapt for a backhand that there was no way I was going to get. And I landed on my left foot really hard and I felt a snap.
Oh gosh.
And then it turned out after ignoring it all summer for 2 months and just walking on it and taping it up thinking, oh, maybe it's just a, you know, something is pulled or maybe I broke a toe. Turns out I had torn a ligament, like our tendon. I tore a tendon in my toe and I had to have surgery.
Oh my goodness.
By November, I was on the couch for 2 months wearing a boot, recovering from foot surgery. And it was basically just the lowest point of the entire experience, because by then I also was laid off by my job. At that time, Hearst was acquiring Rodale. So it was like there became all of these redundancies, as they call them. And it was funny, though, because in the past, if that had happened, I would have been devastated, you know, because this was my career for 7 years at that place. Instead, I was happy because I'm like, oh, cool. I'm going to write my book now. You know, like I have time and they're giving me a severance. This is great. And it was actually did turn out to be fine. I built this freelance career almost like immediately. I had such a good reputation from working so long that I had jobs come my way very easily. But I didn't know that in the beginning. And I thought, oh my God, you know, my bank account is dwindling and I don't have a job and I'm stuck on a couch and I'm a runner. So I was like, oh my God, what if I lost my ability to run? I can't believe I did this stupid list, you know, like what am I thinking and like embracing my dad's free spiritedness. And this is where it lands you. It was really rough. But, you know, one night while I was really in one of those low moments, I actually yelled out loud, you know, give me a sign. Why am I doing this? This is too hard. I think that's what I said. I was like, this is too hard. And like an hour later, I got a message from my uncle, my dad's brother, who I rarely speak with. I got a message from him that my dad's old college roommate had just happened to be cleaning his house. And he came across this newsletter called the Sports and Leisure Newsletter that my dad wrote in 1978. And what it was essentially Facebook, like way before Facebook. Yeah. My dad was always like way ahead of his time. And it was basically just helping his friends and family get together to get discounts on sporting events. And he was also a liquor distributor. So naturally there's like, you know, little like coupons in there for cocktails and, you know, free advertising for his business. And then like there was a page like so-and-so just got a job at DuPont. You know, this person just had a baby. It was just like these announcements. He was creating his own little newsletter.
Yeah.
And the first page of it had like a letter from the editor that he had created. And of course, my mom was the one who wrote it because his handwriting was terrible. And it said, the point of this is to have fun. And it was like, when I read that, I was like, oh, like that's what I need to keep remembering. Like, yes, I'm making a lot of sacrifices. Things are going wrong. I'm stuck on a couch. I'm worried about the uncertainty, but oh my God, the last 2 years have been the most fun years of my life doing this list. And what if like, that's the shift I'm supposed to be making instead of living this life where I'm trying to prove myself in my career all the time. And I'm so afraid of someone else being killed, you know, or like something other terrible thing happening, especially like in the environment we're living in these days. Like there's so many calamities on the news all the time. It's so easy to get into this mindset of like, oh my God, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
I felt like this was his spirit reminding me kind of a simpler time because he wrote the list in 1978 and, you know, and what that feels like to just focus on the good and focus on like the fun you could be having. And just the idea that like, what I like to say is life is not a given, it's a gift. So just the idea that your life is a gift and every day you have a chance to say thank you.
I like that. It seems like his essence really was more of a free spirit and having fun and trying to find the fun in what he was doing. And that is a great message to pass along.
This was a fated thing that I was supposed to be doing. And I think that was the thing, other than remembering to have more fun, I think that was the thing that healed me the most, was this notion that even in a world where it seems like these meaningless things happen all the time, the meaning is actually still there.
Yeah.
And you can make meaning.
You can make meaning, exactly. It's your choice. Like we're making choices every single day.
This list is a list that I think as a parent, I would want for my children, you know, it's almost the gift of everything that he would want for himself. He wants for you as well. And that he has parented you in the absence with this list of all the things of his personality that he would love for you to have. So I think I understand your point to how the anger has left somewhat of how things turned, how it happened, because wow, the gift that I've gotten, you know, that from this tragedy has become this amazing thing. But I also am wondering about your own goals, because it's like he's covered it all, you know. It's like you're like everything here.
There's a lot. There's so much.
Talk with the president, play the piano, guitar, types, you know, visit all these amazing places. What do you want to do? You know,
I wrote my own list.
Okay.
Free, I believe it was 20. It's funny the timing of it. I did it in the beginning of 2020, and I had just like cleaned out my house. So I wrote this list of the things I wanted to do in my life. And I hid it. Like I put it in a box because that's what my dad did. He hid it. Like and my mom found it, I think, in a dresser or something. Now my list is 267 items long.
Wow.
I've checked off 50 of them.
Wow.
a lot of them just along the way while doing, continuing to do his. I would say mine is very hiking and running heavy because I'm an endurance runner. So there's a lot, there's at least 48 different hikes on there, I think. It's a lot of travel, stuff like that. But there is goals for my life and very sincere things. Because that's the thing about a bucket list. I think people think of it as being very whimsical and almost irresponsible. And it doesn't have to be because what I find to be true is that if you actually commit to writing something down that you want to do, there's something about the energy of that that starts to shift your environment. And it starts to, I mean, I've had things I've written down and then like a couple of days later, someone's talking about it, whatever the thing is.
But yeah.
Like it just, your world shifts and it starts coming to you. And I don't think it's a thing where you just notice more. Have you done that? You're shaking your head. Yes.
Oh yeah.
Well,
yeah,
we're,
this podcast happened because we wrote it down and decided to just do it.
Yeah. No, we both have had those. Yeah. It's a constant thread in some of our podcasts that we talk about this is that you need to write it out. You need to say it. You need to manifest it, you know?
Yeah. And this was a thing I was actually going through right before we found the list. I started letting myself feel all this pressure to, okay, well, I'm 38. I better hurry up if I'm going to have children. You know, I'm supposed to care about investing and buying a house now. I'm supposed to really be focused on being a great wife. I'm supposed to be settling into like my gender associated role. Like, those were the messages I was getting all around me. And it was very confusing to me because a year or two before this wedding, I was finally getting published. Like my writing was in the Washington Post now. I was in Runner's World. Like things I had been trying to do for a decade were happening. And it was just because I was writing about distracted driving. I was writing essays about my dad, the story I needed to tell. I was finally telling. So of course, those are the things I'm getting published with. And I just had this real conflict because I thought, okay, it wasn't an issue of, can I be a mom and still do those things? It was more, it seemed suddenly like nobody wants me to do those things anymore. Like they don't matter because what I'm supposed to, like my main goal in life needs to be having children. And I felt like there must be something wrong with me that I'm not feeling that drive, because I think as women we're taught, like biologically, we're supposed to care about that more than anything else. And I just didn't. And yeah, I really went through a time period where that was tough for me. So to have this list show up and it to have like, you know, 8 different destinations on it. And I mean, that to me, that was like my thing that I wrote down, my dream was being made true or was coming true because of my father's spirit, because he was the one person who would have understood. And I would have these conversations with my husband where I would be crying and I'd be like, I just don't think I can be a good wife. I'm too independent. You know, I don't know what you want from me. And he would just say, you know, I just want you to be the happiest, best version of you. And that's what I love about you. And to feel like my father's spirit, who, when he was alive, I would resent that my parents were divorced. Like, I would resent that he was so out there and doing his own thing. To have that be the reminder of, no, it's good to be who you are and be authentic. And this actually makes for a very beautiful marriage. Like, that was exactly what I needed. And so in that way, that was like number one on my list. And it encouraged me to make my own. And I was very afraid that this was going to make me too selfish to have a good marriage. And instead, it made it so that my husband feels like he knew my dad. And my husband has become more intentional in his life. And my husband has a bucket list now. And we have a couple of lists that we made together, you know, and we're not just sort of like, I mean, I don't want to say we were floating through life before, because we really weren't. We were both pretty ambitious, but we feel much more, I think, confident and optimistic about what might be coming down the road for us.
That's beautiful. It's like you were looking, always as kids, and maybe even more so if a parent's life is cut short or there's divorce, you're almost looking for permission to do what you want to do and not what you think you should do. And you got that permission to just be who you are, and you did.
Yeah. It takes time, clearly. You know, it didn't happen right away, but it's taking time. Now, you also, your book, it takes you through the stories of the list of items that you have done. Is that the basic premise of it?
Yeah. And, you know, what ended up happening as I was doing these really fun list items, which is a very present tense part of the book, it is very much a travelogue.
Yeah.
I also would have flashbacks of things from my childhood that I was still coping with, like the divorce. You know, like when I was a teenager, I was diagnosed with depression, and that was a particularly difficult period of my life. And I only share that because it showed that my father had it too, and what that relationship was like. So there are some deep parts of this book, but really it was because it was all coming up for me and I was healing it. And it was just stuff I was still carrying. Like you were just saying about how I sort of needed the permission to live a life of optimism as opposed to one that is like afraid. Like, well, if this happened to dad or if this happened to mom, how do I know it's not going to happen to me? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a gift to everyone. Yes. I mean, because you're basically giving us all a look at dealing with trauma and also how one could not, you could have found this list and not done anything, you know, but how the taking action and making a change, you definitely do own your happiness that you have gotten.
I'm going to make a list after.
I'm so glad. I teach classes on bucket lists now. And
that's cool. Now,
like the first, I'm going to do one this summer. Do you know the actress Melissa Gilbert from Little?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to do one with her this summer. She has a brand called Modern Prairie.
Oh my gosh. That's so great.
Can you even imagine? That's who I was named after. Like I was named Laura because my mom watched that show.
Oh my gosh. I met Melissa Gilbert a long time ago when I was trying to be an actor, and I was in LA for a pilot season, and I met her, and she was amazing.
So cool. Yeah, she interviewed me in October. She's great.
Oh, wow, that's so crazy because that's also a connection. Your name is her name. And
yep, again, my mom was so proud watching that interview.
I can imagine.
Yeah. But I mean, what I do though is like I'll do a step-by-step process, and I actually already did one of these back in January. For another friend. But what we do is the first thing we do is we walk the participants through writing a values list. Mm-hmm. Because what I've discovered, and this is the thing I just did by accident, it was like a Good Housekeeping article where they had all these women who were trying to lose weight write a list of what they valued. And I guess the women who took 15 minutes and wrote down all of their values lost 5 pounds, like or something. And the placebo group didn't lose. And I was getting ready for my wedding. So that's the reason I was like interested. So I was like, oh, I'll do that. I could lose a few more pounds. So I wrote down everything I valued. And of course, it ended up being much more valuable than just about losing weight. I put it in my notebook and now I update it every 2 years. And it's just, you know, I think the goal of that particular article was if you know who you are and what fills you up on the inside, then you'll stop being an emotional eater. I think that was what that was about. But became for me was almost like a Bible. This is who I am. Like, this is what I actually care about. And I think
I love that.
Take the time to do that and actually write down this is who I am. This is my life. That's a huge commitment in itself, really. And then after you do that, that's when you're ready to do the bucket list. Because when you do the bucket list, suddenly the goals are going to be much more focused on, I think, adding to that values list, right?
Yes.
Like adding more value to who you are and what you're doing. And, you know, I had so many times while doing this project where I was just scared out of my mind, like whether it was surfing or the sailing lesson or swimming across a river, you know, like.
I love that one, by the way.
That one was so cool.
Can you just tell me, what river did you swim across?
It was the French Broad in North Carolina. Because we were going down, my stepbrother lives there, and we were going down there for my nephew's high school graduation anyway. Oh. And I just felt like, you know what, like river swimming, that's like a Southern thing.
I think you're right.
Maybe.
Yeah, but it was only like 500 feet across, I think. But it was still, even though it was like a short distance, it was awesome, which I thought was funny because it's called the French Broad. You know, like you think of a broad river. But it still was very like wild. It was like rapids. Also, not to mention, like every month of my life is now scheduled around these things. Like it's not just scheduled around work or what I would normally be doing, even though I'm also still working. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, that's also a very valid point. You're scheduling in the things you want to do.
Yeah. Like I was.
Because you have a list of what you want to do rather than us living on autopilot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm not Cheryl Strayed on the Pacific Coast Trail, like away from everything for 6 months. I mean, granted, like what she did was far more difficult than what I did here, but
I will not be doing that.
But it was like, I wasn't away from my life as I knew it. I was still living it, but I was incorporating this into it. So often what I thought I knew about each item ended up not being at all what it was. Mm-hmm. And I gradually started to realize that we tend to create our own limitations for ourselves because we think we know it, especially at a certain age, we think we know what things are and we actually have no idea.
Mm-hmm. That's the truth.
Yeah. I don't know anything at all.
Yeah,
we don't.
That's the joy, right? That's the joy.
It's also a freedom.
It's a good reminder. It's a freedom.
Yeah, to just be like, actually, I don't know. Well, I just want to say thank you so much. I think I've learned a lot, and I've also changed a little bit of the way I might approach my list. I know that you're going to be at the Literary Festival this weekend, right?
I'll be one of the local authors on May 4th.
Great.
I have my own table. 3 to 5 p.m. on May 4th. I think it's in front of the First Congregational Church.
Okay. Awesome. Wonderful. Awesome. We're just grateful that you came on our podcast. We really learned a lot today and enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
It was a pleasure. It was
our pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
Bye.
Bye. This podcast is produced by Rachel Martens and Jeanette Afsharian. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We hope you share this pod with your friends and family and let us know what you think. Check out our website at lostinjersey.site. And don't forget to get lost.